listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, September 14th. I'm Taylor Fisher from Drake University. Here's our first story. Lakin Foundation contributes $90,000 to Omaha Symphony Bluffs Guild for school-age community programming, written by Sam Pimper on September 13th, 2020. The Charles E. Lakin Foundation recently made a significant commitment to arts access in Southwest Iowa by awarding a $90,000 grant to the Omaha Symphony and the Council Bluffs Guild of the Omaha Symphony for educational programs and community outreach during the next 3 years, according to a news release. Educational and community outreach programs through the Omaha Symphony, now powered by the Charles E. Lakin Foundation, feature programming designed for students from pre-kindergarten through 12th grade, the release said. In addition to educational programs, the Omaha Symphony also provides community outreach through public concerts where access to live orchestra music and arts are limited. We've never received something of this magnitude, Council Bluffs Guild President Kelsey Sutfeld said of the grant, which will be doled out in $30,000 chunks over the next 3 years during an interview with the Nonpareil. So we are very excited for our Southwest Iowa families and children on this side of the river to have more exposure to the arts and orchestral music through symphony. Charles E. Lakin was a philanthropist dedicated to improving the well-being of others through his charitable donations and a focus on civic engagement. The vision and drive he embodied helps to secure and safeguard the future of those in need for many generations to come, according to the news release. His foundation's commitment to the children and families of Southwest Iowa ensures that everyone has access to the arts and live orchestral music. The Council Bluffs Guild of the Omaha Symphony, which introduced the Omaha Symphony to the Lakin Foundation, takes pride in supporting the symphony in its efforts to introduce orchestral music to 4,000-plus Southwest Iowa students each year, the news release said. Members pledged to assist in the Omaha Symphony's educational endeavors in many ways, including through volunteering, fundraising, and providing support to musicians. As the area's only professional orchestra, the Omaha Symphony annually provides educational programming and community outreach programming to more than 45,000 students, teachers, and community members throughout Nebraska and Iowa. The Omaha Symphony is a nonprofit organization that presents more than 100 live orchestral performances from September through June. In addition to masterworks, symphony pops, symphony rocks, movies, symphony Jocelyn, and family series concerts, the Omaha Symphony's nationally recognized education and community engagement programs touch lives of more than 40,000 people each year. For tickets or information regarding the Omaha Symphony and upcoming educational opportunities, those interested are encouraged to call 402-345-0606 or visit omahasymphony.org. Forecast: temps in the 80s on Monday, written by Emily Sheeby on September 13, 2020. A nice day to end the week with a high of 77. Today will be sunny with a slight breeze, according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. Tonight will be clear with a low of 53. Monday will have a high of 81. The forecast according to the Weather Service. Today, sunny with a high near 77, light and variable wind. Tonight, clear with a low around 53. Southeast wind, 3 to 5 miles per hour. Monday, sunny with a high near 81. Calm wind becoming south 5 to 8 miles per hour in the morning. Monday night, clear with a low around 57. Southeast wind around 6 miles per hour. Tuesday, sunny with a high near 82. Tuesday night, clear with a low around 58. Wednesday, sunny with a high near 85. Wednesday night, mostly clear with a low around 58. Thursday, sunny with a high near 78. Thursday night, mostly clear with a low around 54. Friday, sunny with a high near 78. Friday night, mostly clear with a low around 58. Saturday, sunny with a high near 81. Capital Digest: August saw steady gaming revenue and more. Written by the Gazette Des Moines Bureau on September 13, 2020. August gaming revenue. Iowa's 19 state-licensed casinos pulled in a relatively steady revenue in August, but their sports books saw wagering more than double and topped $50 million last month. Monthly reports posted by the State and Racing Gaming Commission indicate Iowa's riverboats and racetrack casinos took in nearly $239.5 million so far this fiscal year, which began July 1st. Admissions were up slightly last month compared with July, but revenue lagged about $1.2 million at $119.1 million in August. On the sports wagering side, Iowans wagered $50.3 million last month, bringing the year-to-date total to nearly $73.2 million. Overall, Iowans have used online apps to place $52.7 million in bets compared with $20.4 million in bets placed in person in the six casinos that don't offer internet wagering. Overall, the state collected $41.2 million in gambling taxes for the 2 months at the casinos and $354,234 in state tax on sports wagering, according to commission reports. Disaster designation extended. Governor Kim Reynolds announced Thursday that she has extended a disaster proclamation for counties affected by the August 10th derecho. The proclamation allows state resources to be used to respond to and recover from the effects of severe weather in 27 counties. Audubon, Benton, Boone, Cass, Cedar, Clark, Clinton, Dallas, Green, Grundy, Guthrie, Hardin, Iowa, Jackson, Jasper, Johnson, Jones, Lynn, Madison, Marshall, Muscatine, Polk, Pawtucket, Scott, Story, Tama, and Washington. In addition, the proclamation temporarily suspends regulatory provisions pertaining to weight limits and hours of service for disaster repair crews and drivers delivering goods and services and the movement of loads related to response to the severe storm throughout the state. Dry August. State officials say last month was the third driest August in 148 years of statewide records despite the derecho. According to the latest water summary update, which did not include this week's rain, significant statewide dryness throughout August caused an expansion of drought conditions with nearly the entire state rated in some form of dryness or drought. The last U.S. Drought Monitor depiction for August showed that 99% of Iowa was in the abnormally dry to extreme drought category, which was the largest expanse since August 27, 2013. For the summer, the state was short on rainfall by nearly 5 inches, which means that Iowa has a significant deficit of moisture to make up for this fall, said Tim Hall, coordinator of hydrology resources for the State Department of Natural Resources. Precipitation deficits of 2 to 4 inches were reported across much of Iowa during August, officials said. Widespread rainfall this week should help to improve conditions in September, Hall said. The current drought monitor shows some limited improvement, but the rain that fell after Tuesday morning will be reflected in next week's drought monitor. For a thorough review of Iowa's water resource trends, go to iowadnr.gov/water-summary-update. Northwest Iowa farmers thank nurses with bean field message, written by Mason Doctor on the Sioux City Journal on September 13, 2020. There is a picture of three men in a cornfield, and they are Sac County farmers Chase Roden from left, his father Dan Roder, and Casey Fredrickson stand at a soybean field where they had planted a message of a heart emoji and the words nurses. Thursday, September 3rd, 2020, southeast of Otable, Iowa. The farmers created the message by planting the letters with a later maturing variety of beans to make them stay greener longer than the background. Otable. Dan Roder holds the nurses of Northwest Iowa in high regard. Several of them are friends and neighbors in Ida and Sac counties, and when there's a farm accident, those nurses are there to help their friends and neighbors. 10 years ago, his son Chase Roder was hurt in a crash on the farm. A nurse who cared for him at the hospital in Ida Grove before he was airlifted to Sioux City was a family friend. When that nurse got home, Roder said, she cried after her husband asked how Chase was. She wasn't allowed to talk about it, but she was overwhelmed by the sight of the seriously injured boy, the son of a friend. We know these nurses, and we need these nurses. As farmers, you know, we get in fender benders, said Roder, 54, a fourth-generation farmer who, along with son Chase and several employee farmers in Ida, Woodbury, Monona, and Sac counties. Really, they, nurses, do a lot for us and everything. I mean, all those hours, all the stress and everything, Chase Roder, 21, told the Sioux City Journal. Nurses had a tough spring and summer when their hospitals were inundated with COVID-19. It was especially hard for nurses whose spouses are farmers. These ladies, they were scared going to work and they were scared of bringing something home. They're probably more scared coming home. They didn't want to pass it on to their husbands because it was planting season, Dan Roder said. Despite the risks, the nurses didn't skip work to shelter at home. But at the same time, a farmer can't be quarantined for 14 days during the critical planting season. It would be ruinous. That's just not an option when you have to plant. You have to plant, he added. Another nurse Roeder knows, who lives in the Schaller area and works at a Storm Lake medical facility, would cry on her drive home after work when the outbreak there got out of hand late this spring. She and her husband thought about living separately for safety's sakes, but she was needed to help around the farm. She was somewhat joking, but she said she prayed half the rosary going to work and the other half coming home that she wouldn't get COVID, Dan Roeder said. In April, Chase Roeder and Casey Fredrickson, an employee who Dan Roeder described as their family, as their farming partner and main guy, came up with an idea. They'd plant a great big sign to celebrate nurses in a soybean field southeast of Otebolt. The lettering would be a later maturing soybean, which would remain green as the surrounding beans, a separate variety that matures earlier, turned yellow and dry. Their high-tech farm machinery was capable of the project, but they needed some technical help. Other farmers have done comparable projects in the past, corn mazes, decorative crop circles, and the like, but this was the first for the Roeders. So they got in touch with Jerry Ulrich, a precision ag consultant at CB Operations, a John Deere dealership in Ida Grove. Ulrich spent 3 hours drawing the letters out on a computer program which sets boundaries where the machine puts seeds and where not to put seeds. Fredrickson, in charge of the planter, seeded the lettering first in the later maturing bean, then cleaned up the machine and did a reverse sweep, planting the other beans that would form in the background. The first pass we made to make the letters, they were set as exterior boundaries, so it would only plant inside of those boundaries. And then we re-switched the field back to make those our interior boundaries, so then when we drove through them, it wouldn't plant them, Ulrich said. Part of the letter R had to be seeded by hand, but otherwise the technology worked flawlessly. The Love Nurses message was largely invisible this summer, because both varieties of soybean, while immature, were an indistinguishable shade of green. But at the end of last week, the earlier beans finally ripened to perfection, leaving the green lettering distinctly visible from the air. As the message began to emerge from the field late in the summer, neighbors grew curious. People would be driving by the field, and they wouldn't say it to us, but they'd mention it to someone else in town or wherever. If they knew us a little bit, and they were wondering, did they spell something out in that field, or what's all those letters, Chase Roeder said. Dan Roeder was initially worried the end result of his experiment wouldn't be satisfactory. He said he wouldn't have told anyone about it if it wasn't, but the field art project turned out about as well as he could have hoped. We were just so tickled it turned out the way it did. It's so crisp and clear, he said. Mother-daughter continued to bond at Primrose despite pandemic. Local facilities prepare to celebrate National Assisted Living Week by Mike Brownlee on September 13, 2020. Primrose Retirement Community resident Phyllis Miller left reads a birthday card with her daughter Deanna Davis outside the assisted living facility on September 11, 2020. The pictures of a woman holding a card to an older woman who is sitting in a chair wearing a mask. For almost a decade, Deanna Davis and her mother, Phyllis Miller, have spent hours at Primrose Retirement Community, daughter filling in mom on what's happening with the family and the world at large. The rain didn't keep Davis away Friday, spending the morning with Miller in rocking chairs on a covered patio area in front of the facility on Canesville Boulevard. We have a couple places we like here. The gazebo, Davis said as it misted. We are grateful for the rain, but it can take a little break. COVID-19 hasn't kept Davis away either. She used to stop by daily over lunch, but now comes around 3 times a week by appointment. They've been so diligent in making sure everyone stays healthy, Davis said, lauding the staff at Primrose for its work to keep the facility coronavirus-free ahead of the National Assisted Living Week, which runs today through Saturday. Primrose is among a number of local long-term care facilities in the area, celebrating their work giving seniors a vibrant life in their later years. Director Tiffany Eggett and the girls, they take their job seriously. Really, it's not just a job, Davis said. They treat them like they're their own grandma or grandpa. Miller has been at Primrose for 9 years. Davis said over the time there have been health challenges. A stroke 2.5 years ago limited her speech, for instance. Davis said she's seen her mother's care evolve in that time. 2.5 years ago, we didn't think she'd still be here, Davis said. They support mom. They support our family. It's a good place to call home. Asked if she enjoys interacting with the girls at Primrose by her daughter, Miller nodded, a grin on her face. Miller enjoys sharing a laugh with staff who have stepped up to help make sure her hair is always looking good as the pandemic has limited visitors and trips to the salon. Miller and her late husband Bill had 4 children. 3 are still alive today, and Miller has 12 grandchildren and 19 great-grandchildren, with a 20th on the way. She recently celebrated her 97th birthday, which included a call with her brother Frank, 92, who lives in Florida and still goes dancing with his girlfriend, and calls from family members near and far. The family is scattered across the country, in Boston, Seattle, Kansas City, and elsewhere. Miller's sister Patty, 90, lives in Minneapolis. "Good German genes," Mom likes to say, Davis said. Miller's looking forward to National Assisted Living Week at Primrose. Eggett said each year the facility has a homecoming theme in tandem with local high school celebrating the occasion. This week features various themed dress-up days along with the crowning of King and Queen on Friday. "We have a nice little gathering. Everything is different with all of our social distancing and the requirement of small groups. It's interesting because this year's theme for the National Week is Caring is Essential," Eggett said, noting the capitalized acronym at the end, AL, which I thought was a fun play on words. On Monday, Primrose is inviting all essential workers in the area, hospital and health clinic staff, fire and rescue and police department personnel, public health staff, and other assisted living center staff for free hero hoagies, a meatball sub, on National Hoagie Day. "For us, it's giving back. The last 6 months have been extremely successful in our industry," Eggett said. "For us, we've been very fortunate. We've had no positive COVID cases to date, which is a testament to the staff, our residents, and their families for understanding our goal. We want to celebrate the week more than ever. More than anything, it's trying to celebrate who we are and to celebrate our residents. We are very fortunate that these residents and their families have chosen somewhere like Primrose to care for their loved ones at the end of their lives, that last bend in their lives," Eggett said, who's been at Primrose for 5 years and in the director role for more than 2, continued. "We are so honored. We really are a family in our building and in our community. These are our grandparents, aunts, and uncles. We really feel that way. We want to celebrate all of them and just have fun. We just need to have some fun." Fun's also on the schedule at Amelia Place off McPherson Avenue in Council Bluffs. Amber Reyes, a community relations manager at the facility, said, "Amelia Place will host a community-oriented event Monday, too, a drive-through ice cream social. Residents, referral and home health partners, and others in the community are invited to stop by for a grab bag of goodies. Residents, that's the favorite dessert," Reyes said of ice cream. "They'll pass on everything else, but they love ice cream." Tuesday will focus on compassion, with Amelia Place handing out goodie bags to first responders, Reyes said. "We'll talk about what compassion means for us to them. Giving them a survival bag, a Tootsie Roll, thank you for the role you play. Smarties because you are so wise," Reyes said, noting residents will decorate their windows with messages of appreciation. Wednesday's theme is Family is Essential, with family visits in person or virtually. Thursday will be Fun is Essential, with a carnival theme, staff dressing up as clowns or some sort of crazy thing to put a smile on their face, and old-fashioned candy for residents. "We are thinking they'll really enjoy some of that," Reyes said. And Friday is You Are Essential, with massages, pedicures, and more, Reyes said. She hopes to have Alona Holland of Life Dimensions, who'd come to the facility pre-pandemic, do something virtual, like a guided meditation for them, Reyes said. "On our end, we'll try to do some stuff, not as good as her, but try to get something nice for the residents on Friday for relaxation because it has been so stressful for them," she said. During the pandemic, the residents have received plenty of community support, despite restrictions on visitors. "The Council Bluffs community has been so supportive of Amelia Place. I had put out a call a while back. I was asking for pictures from kids while they're out of school. Within a couple days, I got loads of mail. I still have some pics I haven't shared yet because we got so many," Ray said. "Just to have that connection to the community is so important, especially right now. It's just really focusing on how do we keep them safe and healthy, but still ensure that they're getting interaction with one another," Reyes continued, addressing COVID-19. "Still having social distancing, they can still chat with one another, so they're not stuck in their rooms all day. I think the biggest part for them has been the isolation. As a team, this is like our second family. They're able to see us and still able to see one another." Davis said that amid COVID-19, she knows outbreaks at some facilities have possibly painted long-term care in a negative light, but she credited those facilities for working to mitigate spread and said Primrose has offered exceptional care. If the county has taken the due diligence this place has, David said while sitting with her mother, we'd all be in a better place. The hardest part has been no hugs, no kisses. This place, not only do they have exceptional care as caregivers, she said, composing herself as a moment of tears started, they've become extended family. The next story is It's Time for Midlands Humane Society 2020 Vision Annual Gala by Corey Nelson from the Midlands Humane Society, September 13th, 2020. We know you've all been waiting for this treasured annual fundraising event geared to help homeless animals in our community, and it's right around the corner. That's right, the 2020 MHS Annual Gala, former known as the Derby, 2020 Vision happens this Friday night at 7 p.m. However, the fun has already started. The silent and live auction portion began a couple days ago. Over 200 items can be perused, examined, compared, and finally bid upon in hopes that you'll be the lucky winner that gets to take the coveted prize home. With categories ranging from pets, of course, children, his and hers, home and garden, dining and entertainment, sports, gift cards, super silent and live, there is something for everyone. Our event software allows options to set a maximum bid and even buy it now. If you find an item you must have and yet don't want the hassle of having to keep watching the status of it, you'll find so many options to pick from. For example, you can purchase a gift card to your favorite local restaurant, the cutest dog or cat bed filled with toys and treats, tasty food and drink, a lovely piece of jewelry, something for the garden or your home, a present for your grandchild, or even a unique excursion or trip. Some items are even packaged up in pretty baskets and ready to give just as they are as a gift. Keep in mind the holidays are coming up, so getting something from our auction might just be the special something you needed to keep your schedule freed up, and let's face it, save some of our sanity that is taxed to the max as the year wraps up. We are so excited to share with you our guest host for the event, Donna Dostal, President and CEO of Pottawatomie County Community Foundation, and Andy Hoig, Publisher and CEO of Metro Magazine. These two phenomenal women possess a love of animals and each have pets of their own. Not only will you get to experience the fun and laughter they exude, but everyone who logs on will hear heartwarming stories, learn more about NHS, and meet adoptable animals. So how will the evening work? First, we encourage everyone to get registered. It's quick, easy, free, and can be accomplished by sending a text to MHS Gala 2020 to 243725 or visiting our website at midlandshumanesociety.org/events. Once you register, you will gain access to more information about the event and you'll be able to bid on all the amazing prizes. We thank all of our sponsors for their continued support of the gala as it went virtual. That tells me that our community is full of individuals, families, other nonprofits, and businesses that care about the welfare of not just the animals that need help, but also the people who share their lives with furry, feathered, and finned friends. Please get registered and join us for the live-streamed event on Friday at 7 p.m., which should last about 1 hour. If possible, you will want to watch the show via your desktop or larger size tablet and keep your mobile device free to bid on items throughout the night. If you win an item, we will have pickup available at Midlands Humane Society on September 19th and 20th from 11 to 3 p.m. and September 21st and 22nd from noon to 6 p.m. MHS Pets of the Week are brought to you by all our 2020 Vision Gala sponsors. Monty is a 1.5-year-old neutered domestic short hair male, and Sasha is a 6-year-old spayed female domestic short hair. Both adult cats are ready to join you at your home. Kiwi is a 3-year-old spayed female rat terrier / border collie mix who arrived as a stray. She is such a happy girl who is full of energy and will be a great addition to an active home that can provide daily exercise. We do recommend that Kiwi be the only pet in the home. Riley is a 2.5-year-old neutered male German Shepherd / American Bulldog mix. His adoption comes with free flow-up training. Riley is a sweet and sensitive guy looking to join a more laid-back home. Riley loves to play, learn new things, and zoom in the yard, and we are pleased to say he knows all his commands as he walks well on a leash. This guy is a big goofball that loves to show off his playful antics. He's working on his social skills with other dogs, but may be most stressful as the only dog, and he does tend to be nervous in new settings. Come visit these great pets and all their friends. We are open during the week from noon to 6 p.m., Saturday 11 to 5 p.m., and Sunday 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. We are located at 1020 Railroad Ave. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, September 14th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Taylor Fisher from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in IRIS at 877-404-4747. Our review. Thank you to Council Bluffs firefighters for efforts to save two children, September 10th, 2020. The efforts of numerous Council Bluffs first responders saved the lives of two young children less than a week ago when a house went up in flames near the downtown area. Firefighters, EMTs, police officers, and paramedics all served in different capacities at the scene of the incident, sharing a common goal: to act swiftly and efficiently under duress to produce the best possible outcome. The men and women responding to the conflagration arrived and handled business without the expectation of a pat on the back or validation. And although first responders were undeniably simply doing their jobs, their effort and bravery enabled a 3-year-old boy and an 18-month-old to escape the burning home's second story with their lives. So the Nonpareil has a simple message. Thank you. Thank you, firefighters and other first responders, for protecting our community in so many ways. Thank you for showing up when others won't. Thank you for putting yourselves into harm's way without immediate concern for your own well-being. Thank you for being a watchdog of our streets, homes, and community. Fire Chief Justin James on Saturday, the day after the fire, took to Facebook praising the effort of his fire squad and other first responders. In his message, he paints a picture of what the responding fire team experienced en route to the blaze. As they left the stations, they could see the heavy smoke coming from the destination, James said. Every one of them, firefighters, were about to face the job they have trained their entire careers for. All of the years of working out, the repetitive hours of drills at the training tower, the EMS classes, the injuries overcome, and the experience garnered from being there before was about to converge on a single job. Arriving at the scene shortly after 7:30 p.m. Friday, Bluffs firefighters were met by officers of the Council Bluffs Police Department, who gathered the necessary intel for the fire squad to dive into action. Two children were stuck on the second floor of home, converted into two apartment units on the 300 block of Lawton Terrace, firefighters were told. The children were rescued and the fire was put out swiftly, Dan Roberts, fire investigator for the Council Bluffs Fire Department, said. The blaze was started by juvenile fire play. It takes a perfect orchestra of individuals who all in the moment understand their part of the performance, James said in a post alluding to the response effort. In the end, this harmony was executed perfectly. It was as good as it can get considering the terrible situations. It was swift and effective from start to finish. I often say that it doesn't matter how many certificates or diplomas we have. It doesn't matter how many awards or accolades. We are here to serve, and it only matters how good we are in the street. Last night, you all, first responders, were as good as it gets. A 21-year-old man and the 3-year-old, both sustaining burn injuries, were transported to medical facilities and treated before being released. The 18-month-old boy, as of Tuesday afternoon, remained in critical condition at the University of Iowa Stead Family Children's Hospital in Iowa City. The child's grandfather, Dave Smith, told the Nonpareil during a Tuesday phone conversation. The boy has burns on about 60% of his body, suffering lung damage from smoke inhalation, Smith said. But he is alive. He has a fighting chance to recover. He may one day live a fulfilling life. You gave a second chance to the victims with seconds to spare, James wrote, praising the responding team. The Nonpareil views the situation in the same light. The effort displayed Friday was valiant, and we believe that similar responses in the future will save more lives. The children involved in Friday's fire have an uphill road to recovery, physically and emotionally, but they have the opportunity to tackle this challenge and walk toward brighter days because of our local first responders' heroics. Again, thank you. Now on to obituaries. The first obituary is Lorna Faye Emsler Haynes. Lorna Faye Emslor Haynes, age 100, passed away peacefully at Mercy Hospital March 28, 2020. She was born January 28, 1920, to William and Verdi Minnick Elms Willer in Modale, Iowa. Faye lived in Crescent, Iowa, the majority of her life until moving to Midlands Living Center in December 2019. Faye enjoyed reading, canning, sewing, and her grandchildren. Her pride and joy was her vegetable and flower gardens. In addition to her parents, she was preceded in death by her husband, Marvin, in 1993, infant son in 1945, granddaughter Kelly Joplin in 2015, 11 brothers and sisters, 3 sons-in-laws, Carl Hatcher, Michael Matthews, and Leon Hansen. Faye is survived by her 3 daughters, Phyllis Hatcher of Council Bluffs, Sandra Matthews of Neola, and Candace Hansen of Missouri Valley, 1 sister and brother-in-law, Lou and Bud Belt of Council Bluffs, and their 2 daughters, 5 grandchildren, Kimberly O'Brien, Jennifer McCants, Ethan Matthews, Melissa Way, and Kristen Livermore, 9 great-grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, many nieces and nephews, and her lifelong neighbors on Pocomo Lane. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. at Grange Cemetery on September 19, 2020. The family will direct memorials. Merle Altmans. Merle E. Altmans, age 74, of Council Bluffs, passed away on September 6, 2020, in Sierra Vista, Arizona, at his daughter Lindsay's home, where Merle and his wife Kathy were visiting for 10 months. Merle was born on August 9, 1946, in Council Bluffs to the late Wilbert Jack and Gladys Eileen Matthias Altmans. He was named for his uncle, Merle Altmans, a Purple Heart recipient who was killed in action during World War II. Merle was raised on a farm east of Council Bluffs and attended the Gilead One-Room School of East Council Bluffs until it was closed when he was in third grade. He and his sisters were bused to Glendale Elementary School and then on to the Underwood Community School, where he graduated from high school in 1964. As a teacher, Merle met and fell in love with Kathy Waters, and they recently celebrated their 54th wedding anniversary. At 16 years old, Merle worked at Hanson's Town & Country Grocery Store on South Omaha Bridge Road. After graduating from Underwood High School, he went to work at Roberts Dairy in Omaha, then drove trucks locally for Beeline Freight and Consolidated Freight, completing 32 years there as a teamster. Merle started working for the U.S. Postal Service, APWU, AFL-CIO in Omaha, retiring in 2019 with over 15 and a half years of driving for them. He enjoyed the many friendships he made at each workplace. His goal of working until he was 78 was cut short by health issues. Some of his favorite memories were coaching great groups of girls for the Underwood Optimists at the elementary and junior high levels for years. Merle enjoyed the many family trips to Glacier National Park in Montana. He was so proud of his children and grandchildren. He loved watching the Miller children participate in their activities at St. Albert School and was an avid New York Yankee fan. Merle spent the last 10 months visiting his daughter Lindsay's family in Arizona, getting acquainted with his newest granddaughter, Regan. Merle was thankful to God for all the years given to him and for his family. He will spend his time in heaven praising Jesus for his gift of salvation and the anticipating reunion of his family there. Merle is survived by his wife, Kathy, daughters Terry, John Miller, and Lindsay and Joseph Escobar, grandchildren Travis and Madison Miller, Reed Miller, Jeff Miller, Laundry Miller, and Regan Escobar, sisters Mary Altmans of Council Bluffs, Carol and John Bertelson of Missouri Valley, Iowa, Beth and William Docey of Underwood, Iowa, and Laura and Dr. Merlin Gibson of Broomfield, Colorado, aunts, nieces, and nephews, and cousins. Open visitation Monday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer, Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Private family graveside service Tuesday in Cedar Lawn Cemetery with Pastor Rich Ritchie and John Reddish officiating. Memorial contributions will be directed by the family. Cindy Lynn Greenlee, age 63, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 8, 2020 at UNMC in Omaha. Cindy was born in Council Bluffs on June 30, 1957, and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School. She worked for Nebraska Furniture Mart in customer service. Cindy is preceded in death by her father, Lauren D., and Thelma June Greenlee, stepfather Bobby Lee, Bobby D. Long, stepbrother Russell Long. Cindy is survived by her mother, Karen Long, daughter Haley Kreitzinger, son Ben and Jesse Kreitzinger, grandchildren Jade Schreer and Bailey Kreitzinger, sisters Joni and Tim Struck, and Wendy Messer Smith, all of Council Bluffs, nieces and nephews, stepbrothers Stephen and Cheryl Long of Heartland, Iowa, Michael and Courtney Long of California, Robert Long of Texas. Roger Lauver. Roger Lynn Lauver, age 68, passed away on September 10, 2020. He was born on July 13, 1952, to the late Eugene and Dolores Rogers Lauver. Roger was an avid fisherman. He loved his grandchildren who meant the world to him. He was preceded in death by one grandchild. He is survived by his wife, Michelle Lauver, children Jennifer Noble, Jill Hensley, and Rebecca Locke. Seven grandchildren, brother Craig Lauver and sister Kim Kohlhoff. There will be no public services. Ruth Benson. Ruth Evelyn Larison Randall Benson, age 91, of Apple Valley, Minnesota, died on September 10, 2020, after a brief hospitalization. A lifelong educator, she was the sixth woman chief state school officer in the nation and the first in Minnesota, serving as commissioner of education from the state from 1983 to 1990. Ruth was born on a farm in Underwood, Iowa, on March 4, 1929, to Olaf and Lily Bondo Larson, the second of six children. She began her career as an elementary school teacher in Iowa and Nebraska and became a principal and administrator of schools in Omaha Public Schools starting in 1967. In 1979, she moved to Minnesota to become assistant superintendent of Independent School District 196, rising to superintendent in 1981. In naming her commissioner of education in 1983, Governor Rudy A. Perpich said she had earned a reputation for drawing students, teachers, and parents into a drive for innovation and excellence. An early advocate of school choice, she also urged state schools to drop Indian nicknames. Her 1991 book, Second Choice, Issues and Answers, explored opening educational opportunities for students. Ruth received her teaching certificate at Dana College in Blair, Nebraska, in 1949, her Bachelor of Science from the University of Omaha in 1961, her Master of Science from the University of Nebraska-Omaha in 1968, and her Doctorate in Educational Administration from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in 1976. It was at UNL where she completed her career as a professor and dean in the 1990s. An enthusiastic traveler for work and pleasure, she visited all seven continents, following a lifelong curiosity about cultures. She often said that the only thing better than being a teacher was being a parent, and as a generous and loving grandmother, she planned special trips for each of her eight grandchildren. A decade-long resident of Council Bluffs, she was a devout churchgoer and was a member of St. John Lutheran in Council Bluffs. She also served on the board of directors for the Lutheran Brotherhood Mutual Fund. She was preceded in death by her first husband of 24 years, Robert Dale Randall, who died in 1975, and her second husband of 10 years, Dwayne Benson, who died in 2008, as well as her grandson, Andrew Christopher Randall, in 1990. She is survived by her children, Robert Randall of Apple Valley, Minnesota, Mark Randall of Rosemont, Minnesota, and Diane Randall of Washington, D.C. Seven grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, as well as a sister, Alvina Hjorts Fang of Omaha, and brother Irvine Larson of Trainer, Iowa. Memorial services are pending next year in Minnesota and Iowa when it may seem to be possible for friends and family to gather once more. Memorials may be sent to Grace Lutheran Church in Apple Valley, Minnesota, or a charity of choice. Maxine Chuchten. Maxine LaVon Chuchten, age 86, passed away on September 9, 2020. She was born on March 28, 1934, to the late Virgil and Elizabeth Ritterbusch. In addition to her parents, Maxine was preceded in death by her husband, Robert, siblings Roy, Ray, Donnie, Jerry, Jack, Bill, and Jill. She is survived by her daughter, Jackie Sanchez, sons Robert Jr. and Danny Chuchten, 10 grandchildren, several great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren, brother Rich Ritterbusch, a host of other relatives and friends. Memorial service is 11 a.m. on Monday, September 14th, 2020, at the Hoy Kanowski Funeral Home. Memorials may be directed to the family. Sharon Clatterbuck. Sharon Lynn Clatterbuck, of age 81, of Council Bluffs, passed away September 10th, 2020, at Bethany Luther Nursing Home after an extended illness. Sharon was born on February 27th, 1939, in Council Bluffs to Bud and May Larson. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband Edward of 51 years, brothers Larry and Buddy. Sharon attended Abraham Lincoln High School with the class of 1957. She worked for many years as the purchasing officer for Cornhusker Casualty Insurance and as a personal banker at Pentagon Federal Credit Union in Omaha, retiring in October of 2008. Sharon and her husband Ed were known all over the Midwest for their handcraft keepsakes and birdhouses they sold at craft fairs. Sharon had a passion for painting, flower gardening, and traveling the world. Her house was featured in the 2010 Council Bluffs Garden Walk. Sharon reconnected with her classmates from high school after the death of her husband and was a proud member of the 57 Club. During her life, Sharon's family was always her first priority. In her later years, she traveled the world with her husband Ed, and later with her friends and relatives after passing. Survivors include son Ed of Eutin, Nebraska, Ron and Pam of Bailey, Colorado, brothers Terry and Grace Larson of Omaha, Denny and Linda, Joe and Kathy of Benton, Arkansas, sister Connie and Rich Kaiser of McClelland, Iowa, grandchildren Chelsea and David Gatewood, Sundance and Chakotay Carson of San Antonio, Texas, Tanner Carmen of Bailey, Colorado, Olivia Carmen of Lakewood, Colorado, sisters-in-law Yvonne Sucker, Connie and Mike Hecker, all of Council Bluffs, Christy and Ted Smith of Broomfield, Colorado, David Stucker of Council Bluffs, nieces, nephews, and cousins. Funeral and visitation open to family members only due to COVID-19. Masks are required. No luncheon due to COVID-19. Memorials may be directed to the family. Charles Yeager. Charles N. Yeager, May 26, 1936, September 8, 2020. Charles Norris Charlie Yeager, 84 years. Born in Oakland, Iowa, raised in Avoca, Iowa, and a 1954 graduate, Charlie worked in computer services for Mutual of Omaha for 33 years before retiring at the age of 51. He enjoyed his retirement by golfing, fishing, and hunting. He was preceded in death by his wife of 54 years, Sandra Yeager, parents Nora and Verna Yeager, sister Shirley Pope, son Craig Yeager, survived by sons Jeff and Rebecca of Blair, Nebraska, Chris of McClellan, Iowa, daughter Terry and Jeff Allen of Gretna, Nebraska, 8 grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, dear friend Patricia Miller. Celebration of Charlie's life will be held Saturday, October 10th, 2 p.m. at Oakland Lawn Cemetery in Oakland, Iowa. Sunday in the Parks, the Playoffs, NFL, a No-Hitter, and More, by Tim Reynolds, AP Sport Writer, September 14th, 2020. The picture is of two football players for the Buccaneers. The quarterback, Tom Brady, number 12, celebrates his touchdown with offensive tackle Donovan Smith, 76, in the first half of the NFL game against the New Orleans Saints in New Orleans Sunday, September 13th. Number 12, Tom Brady, is slamming a football while number 76, Donovan Smith, is celebrating. Lake Buena Vista, Florida. In a year when good days seem short in short supply, sports delivered one. The NFL roared back to life, even if the roar was from fans who weren't in the stadiums. Baseball saw a no-hitter. The NBA and NHL playoffs continued. Men's tennis and women's golf got first-time major champions, and one school reached the AP Top 25 for the first time since World War II. Put simply, Sunday was special. September 13th, 2020 will go down as a day like none other. Of course, it should be no shock that there has never been such a menagerie of NFL games, NBA, and NHL playoff games, and a no-hitter on the same day, with everything else just being superfluous garnished atop that mix. 3 months ago, there was nothing, Los Angeles Clippers coach Doc Rivers said. I'm thankful that there's something now. Something. Sunday had much more than that. It brought a little of everything. At this point, nobody needs to be told why everything in 2020 is different. Racial injustice remains a massive problem. The coronavirus pandemic continues. Sports, the escape the world has from everything, were on hold for much of this year, with all corners of the globe trying to find their way to whatever the new normal will be in a world that includes COVID-19. But on Sunday, even if from afar and not at the stadium or arena, there was so much to cheer again. There were 12 NFL games, including a winning debut for the now Las Vegas Raiders, who topped Carolina, and a big rally for Ron Rivera, whose Washington club came from 17 points down to beat Philadelphia. Rivera, who revealed last month that he's fighting cancer, needed a precautionary IV at halftime. Washington, in its first game since scraping a nickname out of touch with the times, outscored Philly 20-0 the rest of the way. "This is just the beginning of who we can become," Rivera said. Denver became the first team in NBA history to force its way into four consecutive Game 7s. The Nuggets rallied from 19 points down in the second half and ran past the Clippers to force a deciding game in their Western Conference semifinal series. In the NHL, Tampa Bay and New York Islanders combined for no goals in the first 1,887 seconds of their Eastern Conference title series game, and then three in the next 27 seconds, tying for the third fastest three-goal barge in Stanley Cup playoff history. Lightning coach John Cooper arrived for his post-game news conference, however, with one thing on his mind. "What's the score of the Bucks game?" he asked. "Oh, that. For the first time since January 1st, 2000, when he was a senior at Michigan, Tom Brady played a football game in something other than the New England Patriots helmet. Brady's Tampa Bay debut didn't go as planned. Drew Brees and the New Orleans Saints prevailed 34-23 in the matchup of over 40s. Brady is a legend. Alec Mills is a journeyman pitcher who entered Sunday with a career record of 38-46 at the MLB minor league and fall league levels of baseball. Only one of them threw strikes Sunday. Mills, whose only other complete game as a professional was a seven-inning effort in the Carolina League 5.5 years ago, pitched a no-hitter for the Chicago Cubs in Milwaukee, blanking the Brewers 12-0. "I know how much comes along with that," Cubs manager David Ross said after the second hitter of the season. "That's history. You get to make history. That's a special day for us, a special day for Alex Mills. That was fun to be a part of, fun to watch." It was a special day for Miriam Lee, who won her first LPGA major by claiming the ANA inspiration, chipping in for Eagle on the 72nd hole just to get into a playoff. It was a special day for Dominic Thiem, who rallied from two sets down against Alexander Zverev and won the U.S. Open men's title in a classic five-setter at the strangely empty Arthur Ashe Stadium. For the Louisiana Lafayette Raging Cajuns, it wasn't a day like no other. It was just a day like none other since November 1st, 1943, the last time before Sunday that the AP Top 25 football poll came out and they were on the list. It was a top 20 back then during World War II, including such schools as Arkansas, Monticello, Colorado College, Iowa Pre-Fight, and Del Monte Pre-Fight. They went to Iowa State on Saturday and won 31-14, just as the program's second all-time win in 22 tries against Big 12 competition. The Cajuns were ranked number 19 Sunday. "Achieving this national ranking has ignited our fan base and alumni," Athletic Director Brian Maggard said. "The notoriety not only highlights the accomplishments of our football program, but puts our university in the national spotlight as well." The reigning WNBA champion Washington Mystics got a last day of the season win to clinch the last remaining playoff spot in their league, meaning they'll have the chance at back-to-back titles. "This is a sports junkie's heaven right now," Mystic coach Mike Thibault said. "You could sit in front of your TV and watch a lot of different stuff. Thinking back to last April when there was nothing on, we were all searching for what we would do to entertain ourselves. Fun to be a part of getting sports to go again." Indeed, sports are going again. Differently than before, sure, but definitely going again. AP basketball writer Doug Finberg, AP hockey writer Stefan Wino, and AP sports writer Jake Sener and John Marshall contributed to this report. More AP sports, https://apnews.com/hub/sports with a capital S, and https://twitter.com/AP. Racial injustice themes filled empty NFL stadiums. See Sunday's most striking gestures. by Jimmy Golan, an AP sports writer. Jason Myers kicked off to start the Seahawks' season opener against the Falcons, and the ball sailed through the end zone for a touchback. No one moved a step. Instead, the players all dropped to one knee. After years of pleading with the NFL to act against systematic racism, they were willing to wait another 10 seconds to make their point. Teams opening the year in empty stadiums knelt, locked arms, raised fists in protest, or stayed off the field entirely for the Star-Spangled Banner, and the Black Anthem lift every voice and sing on Sunday as the once-reluctant league brought racial injustice to the forefront on the NFL's first full slate of games. In Atlanta, the teams wore armbands honoring civic rights leader John Lewis and staged the most striking of the day's gesture. They barely flinched as the opening kickoff landed beyond the end line, took a knee, and remained there for about 10 seconds before trotting off the field to resume the game. "It's a start," Falcons running back Tom Gurley said after the game. "Are we going to keep doing this? You don't want to make it a one-time thing. Just like having a good game and then the rest of the season you do nothing." Lewis, the Georgia congressman who died in July, was an honorary captain for the game. The Falcons also wore shirts with his quote, "The vote is the most powerful nonviolent change agent you have in democratic society." And that is what the Falcons and Seahawks did before the game. "Everybody voted and said we're going to come together as a unit," Atlanta receiver Julio Jones said. "Collectively, we can move mountains." When fans were absent everywhere except Jacksonville because of the coronavirus pandemic, the Minnesota Vikings hosted the family of George Floyd, who died in May, in a videotaped killing that sparked national protests over police brutality against Black people. Vikings players locked arms in the end zone about half an hour before their game against Green Bay for Lift Every Voice, which was played before each game in Week 1, along with a national anthem as part of the NFL's social awakening. At least six Vikings knelt during the Star-Spangled Banner, something Coach Mike Zimmer had opposed previously. "A couple years back, kneeling was the worst thing you could do, and now if you stand, people have something to say about that," Minnesota linebacker Anthony Barr said. "There's always going to be people trying to divide from inside, but however you feel about it, you should express it your way." About 10 of Floyd's relatives were then shown on the stadio video board from their perch in the upper concourse near the Gjallarhorn, the symbol from Norse mythology, which gave the Vikings their name, has been sounded before every game since 2007. On Sunday, the team said it remained silent to call attention to these silenced voices that collectively work toward a better, more just society. The Packers remained in their locker rooms for the two songs, following the lead of the Miami Dolphins, who released a video last week saying they would stay off the field for the national anthem rather than participate in another publicity parade. "This attempt to unify only creates more divide," Miami's player said in the video, "so we'll skip the song and dance, and as a team, we'll stay inside." The Jacksonville Jaguars, Buffalo Bills, New York Jets, and Arizona Cardinals also remain in their locker rooms for both songs. Before Thursday night's season opener in Kansas City, the teams were booed when they locked arms in a pregame sign of unity. There was no sign of vitriol in Jacksonville, where the Jaguars distributed 14,000 tickets for the only NFL game with fans in attendance on Sunday. A few dozen players knelt during the anthem, a silent echo of the 2016 protest by 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick that forced the NFL to confront racial injustice in a way that Commissioner Roger Goodell and many of the league's most powerful owners wanted to avoid. Colts coach Frank Rich also dropped one knee as his players noticed. "Frank is the leader of the team, and he's the one who says, 'You know, it starts with me,'" Indianapolis linebacker Darius Leonard said. "That definitely means a lot, and that's why we stand behind Coach Frank. He stands behind us, and we all stand together." The Colts were among the teams denying that their protest was unpatriotic, a point Kaepernick also made, but which has often been drowned out by those including President Donald Trump latching onto the issue. "To be clear, we were not protesting the flag, the anthem, or the men and women who wear the uniform," the Colts said in a statement. Patriots owner Robert Kraft lined up with his team when the Black Anthem was played before New England's game against Miami. Quarterback Cam Newton, who made his Patriots debut, appeared to be singing along. The Dolphins remained in their locker room. "It's inspiration," Miami safety Bobby McCain said afterwards. "We have a platform, and we will keep using it." When the anthem began in Detroit, a slew of Lions walked off the field and headed toward the locker room. Some remained on the field and knelt. On the other sideline, several Bears players knelt while 20 Others waited for the anthem to end before jogging onto the field. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Monday, September 14th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Taylor Fisher from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.